The book of Job is both an amazing work of art and a puzzling piece of religious literature. Its centerpiece is a long poem, probably written around 700 BC. The poem is framed by an ancient tale, perhaps 4,000 years old, about a blameless and righteous man who, because of a wager between Yahweh and Satan, loses everything he cherishes, riches, children, and his health. You just heard the prologue. In the epilogue, Job gets everything back and lives happily ever after. But the poem, the heart of the book of Job, tells a very different story. The book of Job confronts us squarely with the problem of undeserved suffering, the suffering of the innocent. God is portrayed as complicit with this suffering. And the resolution, as we shall see, does not offer any clear answers to this problem. In fact, the patience of Job could only be uttered by someone who hasn't read the entire book of Job, excluding Reverend Amy. I find it amazing that this story and poem are part of the sacred canon of Judaism and Christianity. Yet, according to Marvin Pope, Yale scholar and translator and author of the Anchor Bible, Job, the place of the book of Job in the canon has essentially been unchallenged. It is part of what is known as the sacred writings or the wisdom literature and grouped with Psalms and Proverbs. Perhaps the book of Job is in the sacred canon because the suffering of the innocent grips us, or in Tillich's words, is an ultimate concern. The problem of undeserved suffering, of evil befalling the innocent, is the Achilles heel of Western monotheism. Poet Archibald MacLeish wrote a play in verse called J.B. based on the book of Job. It is a play within a play and begins with two characters, Zeus, who will play the role of God, and Nichols, who will play Satan. MacLeish puts this ditty into the mouth of Nichols. I heard upon his dry dung heap that man cry out who cannot sleep. If he is God, he is not good. If he is good, he is not God. This ditty is an eloquent expression of the problem of theodicy. Why does a good God permit evil? We can think of numerous examples where such suffering has caused belief in God to crumble. Peter DeVries chronicles the death of his daughter from leukemia in the novel Blood of the Lamb. In anguish, DeVries cries, "Who creates a perfect blossom to crush it? Children dying in this building, mice in the next, it's all the same to him who marks the sparrow's fall." Eli Wiesel was a teenager when he and his parents and little sister were sent to the concentration camps. After the first night, only Eli survived. His first book, Night, written after liberation of the camps, was both catharsis and testimony. He wrote these chilling words, "Never shall I forget that night, the first night in camp that turned my life into one long night, seven times sealed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the small faces of the children whose bodies I saw transformed into smoke under a silent sky. Never shall I forget those flames that consumed my faith forever. Never shall I forget the nocturnal silence that deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments that murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to ashes. Never shall I forget those things, even were I condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. While we might ask, does anyone deserve to suffer? We make an intuitive distinction. Consider the phrase innocent victims. We are outraged by the senseless killing or raping of children, innocent victims. The phrase innocent victims figures largely in our discussions of the morality of drone strikes as we cringe at the cavalier acceptance of collateral damage. And if we were struck down by disease or paralyzed by a drunk driver, we might well ask, what did I do to deserve this? As a child, I was taught to say, God is great, God is good, we thank him for our food. By his hand must all be fed, give us, Lord, our daily bread. One of my traditionally devout friends recently posted a lovely picture of a rainbow on Facebook with the caption, God is good. We need to think of God as good. How could an evil or malicious deity inspire devotion? How could such a God center a cosmos in which we felt at home, safe, and loved? 2 weeks ago, a devastatingly sudden and massive flash flood in a little community on the border of Utah and Arizona caught and drowned mothers and children. The mayor of the little town, you may have heard this on the TV coverage, the mayor of the little town said, it was an act of God. How can we make sense of that? The universalists separated themselves from the Protestant mainstream with the conviction that God was too loving and too good to condemn souls to hell forever. Even now, when many of us are not theists, our worship often calls upon the spirit of love and life. A meditation may begin, O thou whom we know as love. Congregations say, love is the doctrine of this congregation. A UU minister may close a service with, may the universe pour out its love upon us. But let's be honest now. Are there not times when awful things have happened, dreadful things, and we hear those words, and under our breaths we mutter, yeah, right. The tension between what we behold and feel and what it is tolerable to think gives the problem of undeserved suffering its particular twist and leads us to ask with Annie Dillard, author of Holy the Firm, quote, one of the few questions worth asking, to wit, what in the Sam Hill is going on here, end quote. The prologue to the book of Job ends with Job covered with sores, sitting in the ashes and scraping himself with a potsherd. Yet he says, shall we accept good from God and not evil? A very different Job appears as the dialogue or poem portion begins. Damn the day I was born, the night that said a boy is begot. That day, let it be darkness. God above, ignore it. No light break upon it. Darkness and gloom claim it. Clouds settle over it. Eclipse terrify it. Why gives he light to the wretched, life to the bitter of soul, who yearn in vain for death, seek it like a treasure trove, glad to get to the grave, happy to find the tomb? Three friends come to comfort Job, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They present the standard explanations for suffering. Somehow, suffering must be deserved. Eliphaz asks, is your religion no comfort to you? Does your blameless life give you no hope? For consider, what innocent man has ever perished? Where have you seen the upright destroyed? The comforters are in agreement that somehow Job must deserve his suffering. Job also sees suffering as punishment, as retribution, for he protests over and over that he has done nothing to deserve his plight. Job demands to argue his case with God. This view of suffering preserves the vision of a just and orderly universe. It seems important to believe that we live in a fair world, and we humans are not alone in putting a premium on fairness. Research has shown dogs and primates other than ourselves also seem to have a sense of and a preference for fairness. Perhaps like Job's friends, we reason backwards. If bad things happen, they must be the result of bad deeds. Suffering then is equated to retribution. Think how hard it is for communities to build prisons that are truly organized around principles of rehabilitation. If people are bad, they should suffer. Job is demanding justice. But notice that we use justice in several ways. Justice can mean fair treatment, assessment of guilt versus innocence, which is what Job wants. Or justice can mean bring to justice, where we're really talking about retribution, which is what the comforters assume is happening. As Job continues to protect his innocence, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar list not only the wrongs Job may have committed, but also his sins of omission, the things he didn't do that he should have done. And finally, they suggest it is impossible to be truly innocent, implying a notion of original sin. Bildad says, how can a man be just before God? One born of woman be clean? The concept of original sin gets God off the hook. There can be no such thing as an innocent victim. Then along comes a young man, Elihu, who is shocked by Job's protests and suggests that suffering is instructive. Those who suffer, he rescues through suffering and teaches them by the discipline of affliction. This is the view of C.S. Lewis. In The Problem of Pain, Lewis says, we can ignore even pleasure, but pain insists on being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. But Job will have none of any of these arguments. he will not agree that he is the cause of his own suffering, and is so bold as to question whether or not God is indeed just. But I will not hold my peace. I will speak out in the darkness of my mind and complain in the bitterness of my soul. What is man that thou makest so much of him, only to punish him morning by morning or test him every hour of the day? But it is all one, I say. He destroys the blameless and the wicked alike. When a sudden flood brings death, he mocks the plight of the innocent. The land is given over to the power of the wicked, and the eyes of its judges are blindfold. Let the Almighty state his case against me. I would plead with the whole record of my life and present that in court as my defense. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm.
Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness? When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place? When I said, this far you may come and no farther. Here is where your proud waves halt. Have you ever given orders to the morning, or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment. The wicked are denied their light, and their upraised arm is broken. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. What is the way to the abode of light? And where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths to their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born. You have lived so many years. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or seen the storehouses of the hail, which I reserve for times of trouble, for days of war and battle? What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed, or the place where the east winds are scattered over the earth? Who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm? To water a land where no man lives, a desert with no one in it, to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass. Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from the heavens? When the waters become hard as stone, when the surface of the deep is frozen, can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons, or lead out the bear with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, here we are? Who endowed the heart with wisdom or gave understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together? Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in a thicket? Who provides food for the raven when its young cry out to God and wander about for lack of food?
Is this a response to Job's predicament? Job's pleas for fair treatment? A response that can command devotion, sustain religious sentiment? When I first read this many years ago, I was appalled. It seemed to me like a chest-thumping, "Who the heck do you think you are?" kind of an answer. And it's made all the worse because the reader knows it was a setup from the beginning. Could this possibly answer Job's demand for justice from God? The problem has stayed with me, and gradually a new understanding has developed. Here are four lessons I think we can take from Yahweh's answer to Job. First, it is not about us. We are not the primary players in the cosmic drama. This is a hard lesson. The poet author of Job can be heard as disagreeing with the author of the eighth psalm, who says, "What is mankind that thou art mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them? You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You have made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds and the animals of the wild and the birds of the sky and the fish in the sea, all that swim in the paths of the sea." No. The poet author of Job might be saying, this is hubris. We are merely and gloriously part of that interconnected web of life and death, of order and disorder, of enthalpy and entropy. The more we know about that web of life of which we are a part, the more humble we should become. Our viewpoint is biased, I think, because we are predators at the top of our food chain thanks to our technology. But we are no more immune to tragedy than are the bunnies and the bumblebees. In our complex, interdependent web of life, what is tragic for one creature is success and victory for another. It is very hard for us to accept that we are not special, we who distinguish between humans and animals as if we weren't animals. Second, the imperative for justice and fairness does not belong to the cosmos. It belongs to us. Justice and fairness are concepts that pertain to communities of social creatures. Goodness knows we bungle this responsibility often enough. But it makes no sense to talk about just tornadoes or just earthquakes or just epidemics. Tornadoes and epidemics and earthquakes can't follow the golden rule, but we can try. Living well in a community is a daunting challenge. And in my view, projecting this challenge onto the cosmos is not helpful. It leads to the kind of thinking that Job's comforters were doing. If you are suffering, if you are poor, are homeless, are victims of persecution, You must somehow deserve it. Third, creatures large and small suffer, some because of deeds they have committed, others because of circumstance. The issue is not why we suffer, but what we do with it. Does our suffering deepen our compassion? Do we respond by closing ourselves into isolation or opening ourselves to the comfort of community? When Pope Francis visited the Philippines last January, a 12-year-old girl, Glizelle Palomar, said she'd witnessed drugs and prostitution living on the street before she was given shelter by an aid group. And openly, she wept while she asked the Pope why children were allowed to suffer. Here is the Pope's response. The nucleus of your question almost doesn't have a reply. Only when we too can cry about the things that you said are we able to reply to that question. Why do children suffer so much? Why do children suffer? When the heart is able to ask itself something and cry, then we are able to understand something. This is not an explanation in the standard sense of an answer, but it is an affirmation of the power of compassion and community. Said another way by Teilhard de Chardin, we are one, you and I. Together we suffer, together exist. Forever we'll recreate each other. We do not strive to lead good lives, to be kind and just, in order to reap reward or avoid pain and suffering, but rather because we care, because we are attached to our fellow creatures and invested in their well-being, because we love. We care. Archibald MacLeish ends the play J.B. with this exchange between Job, J.B., and his wife, Sarah. J.B., why did you leave me alone?
Sarah, I loved you. I couldn't help you anymore. You wanted justice, and there was none, only love.
He is not just. He is. He does not love. He is.
But we do. And that's the wonder.
Blessed be.